Thank you very much, Marilyn. We've now got four responses, and given the timing, this means that each of them has to stick absolutely to 5 minutes as a maximum. I want to invite Michael Sorkin, principal of Michael Sorkin Studio, to kick us off, if you will, Michael.
God, so much to say, so little time. I begin with an anecdote, maybe apocryphal, that has been spoken about a meeting between Nikita Khrushchev and Zhou Enlai. And they had a few Mai Tais. And Khrushchev was being very voluble, and he said to Zhou, God, isn't it an amazing thing? You know, here we are from such very different backgrounds, and yet we have so much in common. Me, the son of a peasant, you, the son of a mandarin, and we have both risen to be the leaders of great socialist states. And Joe tilted his glasses, looked down his nose at Khrushchev and said, actually, the only thing we have in common is that we are both traitors to our class. I bring this up only to make a few remarks about the mode of production of the kind of urban space we are talking about. Let me speak briefly about the kind of hierarchy of decision makers who ultimately reflect the kinds of actions we take in our cities and neighborhoods. I mean, we are mired, let's not make no mistake about it, in an era of rule by plutocracy, and I think the chain of command manifests itself. Bush, white millionaire. Pataki, white millionaire. Mayor Bloomberg, white billionaire. Yeah, exactly. Deputy Mayor Doktoroff, the postmodern Robert Moses, white multimillionaire. And Planning Commissioner Burden, white millionaire. Do I make a mistake? Female, yeah. I only need to suggest that the idea that we create a structure in which the altruistic betrayal of class interests is the be-all and end-all of urban planning may not be the most salubrious and practical way of doing things. I think the predomination of this set of interests is reflected in the series of major initiatives that the city has taken. The rezoning and reconfiguration of the West Side in order to allow for more office development that we don't need. The Bruce Ratner project in Williamsburg, more giveaways, use of eminent domain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The upzoning of Williamsburg, of which a little more later, the whole debacle of the LMDC and the reconstruction of Lower Manhattan, another panel of plutocrats deciding essentially that what we need is more office space. And our whole kind of fascination with the idiocy of stadiums. There was a piece in the paper the other day suggesting that we are at the point of subsidizing the three stadiums that are being spoken about with public money to the tune of $1.2 billion. This is a totally idiotic and mistaken priority. So, if we have rule by plutocracy, producing large-scale profit projects that essentially are for their own benefit, what does this mean about a vision of for whom the city is intended? I revert to Max Bond's telling comment of the other day. Look around this room. Are we the constituency for these operations? Upper middle class, largely white folks? I believe the answer is yes. It's $700,000 median price for an apartment in Manhattan. The city for years, despite bromides, has been losing affordable housing. We are in the process of creating a city that is divided into, as Lucan would have it, essentially served, that's for us, and servant spaces, that's for the increasingly marginalized service workers who walk our dogs and tend our babies. Part of the problem with this is that we are mired in a system in which public engagement is still stuck in an oppositional mode. We've heard a lot of talk about stakeholders' rights, but stakeholders' rights are intimately related to the power of stakeholders. What is the actual persuasive power of a 197A plan? What is the actual persuasive power against the interests of real estate and development of community groups? I am unimpressed by and large, by the styles of public engagement that tend to be characteristic of the city. One of the issues, I think, in terms of the way we plan, is that the zoning paradigm is a fossil. I do not believe that use zoning is the way to determine the future of the city. I think we need to plan more boldly, and I think we need to plan more boldly at the level of public bodies and public administration. Zoning, preeminently, is a proposition about use and not about population. We need to think about the populations we wish to serve and the populations that we have in the city. In that sense, you know, an instrument for assuring the continuity of populations that is much more powerful than zoning is rent control and rent regulations and price controls. I think this is the only way to retain viable neighborhoods. I would not be in Jane Jacobs' beloved Greenwich Village were it not for the rent laws of New York City. And I dare say if those laws were to disappear, everything we admire about that neighborhood would be gone in 20 minutes. I think we have to think about for whom we are doing these projects and not for what series of uses. Lively street-level commerce is one thing, but there's a big difference between Fairway and Zabar's. This is something we have to think about very hard. 1 minute, okay. Finally, you know, in terms of, you know, I yield to no one in my admiration for the work of the HPD, and, you know, we must bring up the name of David Dinkins, who was instrumental in initiating the programs that led to all these housing conversions. But I dare say the flaw in the proposition for Williamsburg, like so many other propositions, is the same flaw of the bonus system more generally. Which is to say, one trades a nominal public good for a density that presumably is not intended for the public good. And the thing that's going to defeat the idea of so-called inclusionary zoning is, as Ron and I were talking, it's voluntary. We depend, again, on the altruism of developers to deliver a service that we, as a city, should be providing. So I end with this distinction.